Hey, Fresh from the Hill listeners. I'm so excited to present this special Halloween bonus episode. In today's podcast, we'll be featuring the stories of four Cornellians. Some of the stories are real, some are not. I'll let you be the judge of which is which, but for now, sit back and enjoy these spooky Cornell tales just in time for Halloween. So I am here with Jacob Sackett. And Jacob, what's your class year and what did you major in at Cornell?
I was an agricultural sciences major and I graduated in 2015.
So I understand that you have a spooky, creepy story to share with us today.
Yeah, it's kind of a series of creepy stories that occurred I was at Cornell.
Great. Let's hear it.
So my girlfriend was in Alpha Phi, and we spent a lot of time there while she was living there her sophomore year. So I believe that would have been 2013 or so. And we spent time, you know, in the basement where they have a big TV and kind of a workout area. And, you know, we always kind of felt a little funny down there. And I know the history of the house is that it may be, you know, we've heard it was haunted and whatever, but maybe that contributed to our feelings. But one time we were down there, this is one thing that stands out, and we're watching a movie. We've been down there maybe an hour or so, and there's a coffee table with a stack of magazines, and it's kind of near us, but not too close. And the magazines just slid right off the table and onto the floor very abruptly, and it definitely startled us. And I think that was really the thing that we remember as being the real haunting story from the house. But I also recall other things happening, like in that same room, there's a closet sort of where the, if I'm remembering correctly, where they have the laundry. And we were in there, you know, I was just standing there talking and she was doing her laundry and the door was cracked open and we were down there alone. And the doorknob just from the outside towards us, it appeared, started like rattling and turning and we could see it and hear it. And we were definitely startled by that as well.
And there was nobody on the other side?
No, I checked. It was very creepy.
Well, that is certainly creepy and scary. And I really appreciate you sharing your story with us today, Jacob.
Yeah, of course. And I feel like there is some interesting history behind the house. Which could contribute to its activity, but that's my story.
Awesome. I am here with Marie Seske, and Marie is going to tell us her spooky, scary ghost story. But first, Marie, can you tell me what year you graduated from Cornell and what you studied there?
Yeah, so I was a government major. I'm actually class of 2020, so I'm graduating this year.
Oh, gotcha, current student, great. Perfect. So, yeah, why don't you just jump right into your ghost story for our Halloween episode?
Okay, perfect. So this is a story that happened to me and my friend Joe last year. It was Friday night of Hall weekend, and we had made our way to fraternity in the Cayuga Heights section of North Campus with a group of our friends. After getting separated from the rest of our group and missing the bus home, which had driven past us without stopping, we decided to make the trek back to College Town on foot. The Earth Squad was eerily quiet well after midnight, the trees engulfing the small paths through seemingly endless darkness. We could hear the sounds of crickets chirping and the leaves rustling around. No one was in sight. As we entered the deep blackness and made our way closer to the statue of Ezra Cornell, Joe began to joke that this was the perfect setting for the beginning of a horror movie. He noted that if I were by myself and someone attacked, no one would be around to help. I pleaded for him to stop as my mind wandered and my pace quickened. He then mentioned that I should really watch The Good Place, but I pushed back, knowing that a TV show about the afterlife would freak me out. My thoughts were soon interrupted, however, by the sound of someone's feet hitting the pavement. A man wearing an Aladdin costume came into view from the darkness behind and ran past us towards Hope Plaza, looking behind his shoulder as he passed. We thought nothing of it, merely each non-verbally noting that it was an odd time to go for a run. We continued our meandering pace. In the distance, we could now see another figure coming up behind his first runner. The second man slowed to an exhausted and out-of-breath stumble as he approached and stopped, trudging a few paces behind. He hung uncomfortably close in our blind spot for a few seconds before picking up his speed to pass us slowly on the left, looking over us and muttering as he walked. We stalled, trying to give him space. He then jogged a few belabored paces before coming to a complete stop about 20 feet in front of us. dead in his tracks, he stood in the center of the path, staring up at the clock tower. Unmoving, he buckled his knees and stared. Joe took a few paces back, prompting me to do the same. But in response to our motion, the man instead turned to face towards us. He was wearing a monk costume, a long brown robe with a hood and a giant wooden cross draped down his chest. While the clock tower illuminated the cross around his neck, his face remained cast in shadow. The three of us stood at a face-off for a few seconds, meeting each other's gazes in silence. We were mere feet apart. I froze. I wondered if he would confront us, if he was armed. There was no one around. I began to question our ability to fight. Joe continued to back up and then turn, prompting me to do so as well, so that we were now walking the other way. The man in the monk costume continued to stand still, however, staring towards us. Our pace quickened the farther away from him we walked, continuing to look over our shoulders as we rounded behind the statue of Ezra Cornell. I fought to quiet my panicking breath. "It's fine. He should be gone now," Joe reassured me. We had now rounded the Ezra statue and were walking around the back of Morrill Hall. "Let's just walk around this building and we can cut back into the art spot towards College Town," he suggested. "No, let's go to West," I countered, arguing that it was closer, downhill, and our friend Julie still lived there. While we debated, Joe becoming more convinced that Hope Plaza was a safe bet and me refusing to enter back from where we came, I turned around to see that the monk costumed man had also rounded the corner and was now looming next to the edge of Morrill and Ezra Cornell, staring at us. I started to panic power walk, pulling at Joe's jacket to drag him close to West Campus. "Run to Julie," I exclaimed, as we jogged towards the steps that led us down the center of Lab Slope. I was practically hyperventilating, my breath quickening as I frustratingly tried to awaken Joe's seemingly dormant sense of fear and get him to move faster. "It's fine, I think he's gone now," Joe reassured me, after I had rapidly skipped down the initial steps. "Are you sure?" I slowed my pace to balance down the steepest point of the descent, exhaling and trying to calm myself. It seemed we were now safe. "Never mind, he's cutting across the slope. Run, run," Joe screamed, filled with alarm. "What?" I froze in my disbelief. "He's chasing us, run." Joe grabbed onto my arm, pulling me out of my stupor. He linked onto my elbow to balance me at full speed as I screamed and fumbled in my heel boots, barely keeping myself upright and preventing my ankles from buckling under an uneven footstep. We plundered down Lab Slope, Joe dragging me as I struggled to keep up, haphazardly launching one foot in front of the other. "He's catching us, run, run." Joe's previously calm voice was now raised to a quivering panic. I didn't even have time to look back, focused on running at my fastest speed possible without tumbling. As the slope began to flatten, though, I looked across my shoulder to see the figure of a man sprinting diagonally across the slope at terrifying speed, soon to catch us from a short-cutted approach. I changed the grip of Joe's stabilizing arm to grab his hand instead so that we could quicken to our independent, unhindered speeds, our grip ensuring that neither one of us lagged behind. The monk was getting closer and closer. I could feel him behind us, see his shadow, and feel his footsteps mere feet away. We sprinted across the street, separating the slope from Baker Flagpole. The man was now just directly on the other side of the road, mere seconds behind. "Run to Julie! Run to Julie!" I exclaimed again, as we ran through the archway and down the steps into deeper West Campus. Somewhere on these steps, though, it occurred to me that neither of our student IDs had keycard access to Beta, the dorm where Julie lived. Everything was closed, except perhaps noise, which we had already passed and would require a sprint up a series of long steps uphill. I was running out of possible breaths. Since we were actually running, there was no way to call Julie to let us in, no guarantee she'd even be awake. I began to internalize that her predetermined safe haven was locked, that we would soon likely come face to face with a man chasing us, unable to slip inside to safety. Yet just as this new oh shit moment began to really set in, before I could fully strategize another option, at the bottom of the steps separating Beta and Rose houses was a pitch tent illuminated, people standing underneath. "To the tent," I exclaimed as we ran right to this group, only slowing once we had reached underneath the safety of its glow. It was the Student Assembly's Health and Wellness Committee, stocked with water bottles and bananas to ensure that students were safe on Halloween. Upon our approach, a friendly student immediately asked us, "Hi, how have your nights been?" We both looked back over our shoulder. The man chasing us was now nowhere in sight. He had seemingly disappeared. "Well," I exclaimed, we were sort of just chased down the slope." As I proceeded to explain our story, the two concerned members of the SA listened in disbelief and urged us to let them call the incident to Cornell Police. We filed a report over the phone. Unsure about walking back to College Town at that particular moment, we met up with Julie, later accepting a police walking escort from West Campus to College Town. The chief of police soon arrived at the bottom of the slope for our escort, slamming her car door closed as we stood on the sidewalk nearby. We sent a few cars around looking for anyone suspicious in a monk costume and couldn't find anyone who matched your description, she informed us. "We'll keep looking, though, and let you know, but let's walk you home first." She escorted us safely back to her College Town apartments, and we have heard nothing since. Nor have either of us seen anyone in a monk costume. For all we know, as the police suggested, the monk was just a student on drugs looking to pick a fight, perhaps a fellow classmate or even our own neighbor. His identity remains a mystery. Perhaps he's hiding in plain sight. Perhaps he disappeared entirely. Regardless, heed our warning. Avoid the art spot on Halloween night.
All right, so I am here with Subhashini Gangatharan, and she has a ghost story to share. But first, just doing introductions, can you tell me what your class year is and maybe what you majored in?
Sure. I am Cornell, class of 2013, College of Arts and Sciences, and I double majored in English and film.
Oh, great. Awesome. So I understand that you have a spooky story that you'd like to share with us today. So I'm just going to let you have the mic and go ahead and share it.
Sure. So from my major, you can probably tell that I like stories. And I've always had a thing for the supernatural, the spooky, and the what have you. And outside of all of that, I'm a pretty rational, logical, data-driven person. I'm a product manager at a software company today. And so it does come as a surprise to people that I have an affinity for these kinds of subjects. And so I've been asked the question in the past, why do you believe in these things? Like, you know, have you ever experienced anything? What's your logic here? And I always share this story. So I was a freshman, and as you may know, all freshmen are guaranteed housing, and after your first year, you have to enter the housing lottery to secure on-campus housing. You always have the option of securing housing off-campus, but there's this housing lottery that you have to participate in because everything at the school is really competitive. My friends and I, we participated in the lottery, and we secured ourselves a suite in West Campus, Hans Beta House. And it was before our freshman year ended, and we amongst ourselves decided to just check the house out. So we went down to West Campus one evening, we had dinner at the dining hall, and then we just thought, oh, let's go up to our suite. Maybe the people who live there now will be there, and we'll go see how big the rooms are, see what the layout is like, and see if there's, you know, anything we want to plan for ahead of time. So we did exactly that. When we got there, I actually don't remember right now if the people who lived in the suite were there or not at the time, but I do remember very distinctly as we were leaving, I was walking a little bit ahead of my group, and in front of me, I saw this young woman. I distinctly remember her. She had long past her shoulder brown hair. She was wearing a black sweatshirt with some kind of pink print on the back, these jeans and she had one of those like spiky belts. She looked like someone that had not gotten over her Hot Topic phase. So I saw her, and we were headed towards the elevator, and right as I reached the elevator, the door closed. And I remember calling out after her, like, hey, hoping that she would press the open button and keep it open for us, but she didn't. And then I thought, okay, let me just press this button. So after it drops her off wherever she's going, it'll, you know, come back up to us like right away. But it opened like my heart, like for within a single heartbeat, the elevator doors opened again. And no one was inside. So in the real world, elevators are pretty fast, but if you've lived in Hans Beta House or ever been in there, they're not fast at all. It can take you 30 seconds, which doesn't sound that long, 45 seconds, let's say, to go a single floor, which is a really long time for an elevator. And so there was no way that she went downstairs and the elevator came right back up. Like, that definitely wasn't gonna happen. But I thought, okay, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I imagine things. I'm not, whatever. So I go into the elevator, but like me and my friends, we were all really quiet. And one of the friends that I was with, she says, hey, wasn't there supposed to be someone in here? And we all kind of looked at each other and didn't really know what to say. I said, yeah, there was supposed to be someone in here. but we just didn't know what to say. Maybe we're all having like a collective hallucination. So we just went, we just walked out of there, went back home, but we were very, very, very freaked out because something happened. There's no rational explanation for what happened, but it did. And there were multiple witnesses to corroborate the story. So again, maybe we had a collective hallucination. Maybe there was something with the food or the air in Hans Bethe House. But yeah, it was very freaky.
And is that something that you and your friends still talk about today?
All the time. All the time. So I actually, this past Sunday, grabbed brunch with the friend of mine who was like, hey, is anyone in here? And we still talk about what happened. And it's Cornell gave me a lot of memories. That's definitely one of the more unique ones, I would say. But yeah, I talk about that all the time amongst, you know, friends who were there, friends who weren't there. I talk about it at work. Like, it's, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's such a spooky story. I'm so glad that you were able to share that with us today.
Yeah, happy to do so.
Yeah, thank you so much.
For those of you
living in Hans Bethe House. Yeah, right. Beware of the girl with the spiky belt.
And her Hot Topic fashion.
Exactly. I'm here today with Garrett Hastings. And Garrett, what class year are you?
Class 2019.
And what was your major at Cornell?
I was archaeology and PMA, and I focused in film.
Great. So I understand that you were a part of a club on campus that told kind of scary, spooky ghost stories. Can you tell us a little bit about that club?
When I was a freshman, I heard everybody and I were talking, and I was telling some scary stories, and I decided that I liked the idea of deciding this club. Scare me. Actually, the first one to come up with an idea was the Blue Light Tale. And I figured that it'd be good to see if other people were interested. And it started out as just a couple of us. And it went from there. And it really became a place, not only just being able to tell scary stories, but being able to really bring in your own, you know, our own horrors. And for a while, it was just like slightly veiled horror stories of, like, you know, something like bad would happen, or like a prelim or something, for example, you know, turning that kind of thing into like a horror story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really not just a place of just being, not just like ghost stories, like any kind of scary story. And it's supposed to be like a safe place where you can tell your own horrors, you know, feel comfortable, be able to speak out. And people at first don't necessarily talk at first, but they eventually warm up to the idea. And the idea is to try to make them feel comfortable and be able to tell scary stories eventually. I had one theme that was Dead Poets Society, and the theme was really, the scary part was really putting yourself out there and actually, you know, standing up, and the stage fright basically was the theme. So every week I came up with different themes, or I did come up with different themes. Now the current president is Eliza, and her contact information, which I will give you now. The contact information is ebf43@cornell.edu. So that's ebf43@cornell.edu. So she is the current president, it's Eliza. And so if you want more information about how to get involved and all that, please feel free to email her. So it still happens on every Saturday night at Risley Hall at 10 p.m. And so feel free to come by and tell a scary story right away. You can even come to listen. There's usually snacks involved, which is good because, you know, the kind of a feel of Halloween. I gave her one of my fake candles. I brought those in for a while to kind of have the setting feeling of Halloween. So every Saturday night is Halloween. And I really hope it expands and goes beyond my time here, and it goes beyond Eliza's time at Cornell, because it's also her last year as well. So, please come on.
Yeah.
Enjoy sport, bring scary stories. If not, feel free to come and listen. And,
yeah.
Hope you enjoy this.
So I feel like that's a good lead in. Can you share your story with us?
Sure. Okay. And you all know about the blue light system on campus? I see. This story was passed on to me, so it's my duty to pass it on to you. This tale begins how it always ends, with a pile of ash in the Willard Strait fireplace and disappearance. Students never knew to follow the unexplainable blue lights, and that randomly appeared around campus in the dead of night. It was just common knowledge, but the practice changed once the popular blue light system was installed. People now look to the blue lights as security and safety. And they say that if you stand at one, you can see another. They exaggerate this a bit, but for the most part, this is valid. You only really notice it after sunset. Wilson was a sophomore biology major in Cal's. He was a relatively average kid with a couple of friends, and they would enjoy themselves every now and then. And on this particular night, Wilson had been trying to talk to the girl of his dreams at one of those casual parties. He had finally gained enough courage to ask her out as friends grabbed him to leave. It was that time of night where the buildings are as dark as coal. Even the bright college town of Ithaca, New York, can be an inky black abyss. Wilson walked with his friends for some time before he peeled off alone towards his dorm. Unfortunately, he had no light. His friends had the flashlights and his phone was dead. He thought about using the blue lights and possibly calling the CUPD to bring him home, but he didn't think it was an urgent situation. Instead, he would use the lights as a trail of breadcrumbs, illuminating an escape through the black unknown. He recalled that if you stood at one blue light, you could see another, thus making an easy walk back. So Wilson traveled from one blue light to the next, making his way back to the dorm. He continued for a while, and as he walked, he heard an electrical surge that built in intensity with every passing blue light. He thought of nothing of it and supposed it was the bulbs from the lights. He kept walking until the sound of electricity was almost unbearable. Standing under one blue light, he could feel the electrical surge pulsating his skull, so he darted off to the next one as this increasing sound and pulsating when Wilson began to panic. "I need to get back now," he thought as he strove towards his next target. Picking up his speed, Wilson pushed on towards the next blue light and seemed to maintain his distance. The noise increased with every step, and the pulsating in his brain grew worse. A migraine formed as his cranium throbbed. He needed to get back now. He picked up his pace faster and faster. The more he moved, the further the light seemed. He seemed to accelerate into a jog, a run, a sprint. He dashed as fast as his legs would take him. Faster and faster he ran. He accelerated beyond the speed he thought could possibly conceivably run, and while the pain in his head increased, and his brain felt like it would burst. Yet the distance to the blue light remained the same. No matter how hard Wilson tried, the light seemed to position himself from the edge of his field of vision. Wilson tried to cry from his constant failure, but no tears were shed as his bodily fluids were concentrated into the rivers of sweat streaming down his face. Panicking, yet from not reaching his destination, Wilson wildly studied his surroundings. To his horror, he had no idea where he was. He tried to gain some sort of environmental understanding, only saw thick forest and dense trees. He darted through them, getting hit by every other branch across his path, trying to stop himself, but physically couldn't. It was like the blue light was dragging him towards it, like an accelerating beam from which he cannot break away. He tried to turn and noticed the fading lights of College Town behind him. "Why can't I stop? Where am I going?" he thought. He tried as hard as he could, pull away, stop anything, but he couldn't. It was futile. He could just continue accelerating faster and faster, faster and faster. Then he smelled something that caused his head to ache. With feverish intensity, he looked down. His feet were on fire. They were physically on fire. Wilson tried to scream, but he was too out of breath. His mouth had dried up. His unwillingness ran faster and faster. He could see finally where he was closing and enclosing him in the blue light. He could feel the heat, the electrical surge, course through his brain and made his ears bleed. The blood mixed with sweat as it poured down his face into his gaping mouth. His brain felt like he was trying to make his escape through the holes in his ears as it attempted to burst his head. He was propelled through the light faster and faster until he accelerated so fast he was lifted off the ground and... The next morning, there was a pile of ash in the Willard Strait fireplace. Don't follow the blue lights.
Thanks so much for checking out our special Spooky Ghost Stories episode. Be sure to rate and subscribe to Fresh from the Hill wherever you listen to podcasts. And tell your friends. If you have ideas for the show, please contact me at amanda.massa@cornell.edu. Music for Fresh from the Hill was produced and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2013. You can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu. For more information about Cornell Young Alumni programs, please like us on Facebook and visit our website at alumni.cornell.edu/youngalumni.